Welcome to PwC IFRS Talks, your source for all things IFRS. I'm your host, Rahaza Sheikh. In today's podcast, my return guest is Karsten Gansauri, who's going to be telling us about the developments at the March IFRS Interpretations Committee meeting. Welcome back, Karsten.
Glad to be back, Rahaza.
And this is actually the first IFRIC meeting of 2023, given the cancellation of the previous meeting. One of the items that the IFRIC discussed was the tentative agenda decision on the definition of a lease with respect to substitution rights. And we covered this in the November IFRIC update. For a background of the issue that was submitted, listeners can refer back to episode 138, so I don't suppose we go into a lot of detail today. This month, the tentative agenda decision was finalised by the IFRIC, that is, subject to the non-objection of the ISB board, with a few clarifications. One of the most critical changes, which seemed to resonate with a couple of those that had submitted comment letters, was the clarification on interpreting what throughout the period of use means. And the IFRIC clarified that this does not mean at all points in time. So we look forward to seeing that agenda decision being finalised, hopefully at the next board meeting, and we'll keep you posted once that is. There are also three new items for initial consideration. Let's begin by discussing the topic of homes and home loans provided to employees. There were two fact patterns that were submitted to which the IFRIC were asked on how an entity accounts for A, homes it provides to its employees, and B, loans it provides to its employees to enable them to buy homes. Karsten, can you explain what the accounting issue was that the committee was addressing?
Sure. So the first fact pattern in the submission was around employee home ownership plans, where an entity provides employees with a house that the entity owns. In return, a proportion of the employee's salary is deducted every month until the agreed price of the house has been fully paid. Now, if the employee leaves employment, the employee would either forfeit the house and recover the salary deductions to date, or in some cases, depending on the duration of employment, the employee may keep the house and immediately repay the outstanding balance. And the second fact pattern in the submission was around employee home loans, where an entity provides its employee with a loan to buy a house. Now, the loan would be at a below market rate of interest, typically interest-free, and the employee repays the loan through salary deductions. And if the employee leaves employment before the loan has been repaid, the remaining outstanding balance of the loan becomes repayable. Now, the submission essentially asked how the entity would account for these two fact patterns.
And where did the committee land on this submission?
Well, the outreach did not indicate that these fact patterns are widespread or that the amounts are material, and therefore the criteria for adding the submission to the work plan were not met. So just as a reminder, the due process handbook sets out certain criteria that must be met in order for the committee to address the matter, to ensure the resources of the committee are used in an efficient way. And these criteria were not met for this submission, and so consequently, the committee did not address this matter.
Thanks, Karsten, and that's a helpful reminder of the due process. So let's move on to the next submission then. Now, this next issue, the committee considered the accounting of a guarantee over a derivative contract, and the submission asked whether the guarantee over a derivative contract is accounted for as a financial guarantee contract or derivative by the entity that's writing the guarantee, so that is the issuer. In the tentative agenda decision, the staff had proposed that this was also quite a narrow fact pattern that was not widespread and the amounts involved were not material. And therefore, it was concluded that the matter described in the request is in isolation too narrow for the ISB or the committee to address in a cost-effective manner. So again, I don't suppose we go into a lot of detail, but I did want to get your reflections on the discussion on where the committee landed and, you know, whether they were in agreement with the staff proposal.
Yes, the committee were in agreement with the staff proposal to deal with this in a similar way as the previous matter. So similar to the submission on homes and home loans provided to employees, outreach on this matter did not indicate that the matter would have widespread or material effects, and consequently, for similar reasons, the committee decided not to add a project to the work plan as proposed by the staff.
Thanks, Carsten. So then moving on to the third new submission. This was on the accounting for insurance premiums receivable from an intermediary. I personally thought this was a really interesting question. You know, it's one that can be linked back to challenges that we often see on scoping between two different standards. And in this case, it was between IFRS 17 and IFRS 9. So Carsten, can you begin by providing a brief background of the submission?
Sure. So I think we have clearly seen an increasing number of submissions that relate to issues around the scoping of standards. That is, you know, which standard applies in particular fact patterns. And I agree that those kinds of questions are quite interesting and also often quite challenging. So this submission was asking for guidance on how an insurer applies the requirements in the standard on insurance contracts, IFRS 17, and the standard on financial instruments, IFRS 9, to premiums receivable from an intermediary. So in the fact pattern described in the request, an intermediary acts as a link between an insurer and a policyholder to bring about an insurance contract between them. The policyholder has paid in cash the premiums to the intermediary, but the insurer has not yet received in cash the premiums from the intermediary. Now, when the policyholder paid the premiums to the intermediary, the policyholder has discharged its obligation under the insurance contract, and the insurer is obliged to provide insurance contract services to the policyholder. And in case of default of the intermediary, the insurer does not have the right to recover the premiums from the policyholder or to cancel the insurance contract. So on a high level, that is the fact pattern that has been submitted to the committee.
And what was the accounting issue that the committee was addressing?
So in simplified terms, the request asks whether the premiums receivable from the intermediary are accounted for under IFRS 17, or whether they are accounted for as a separate financial asset applying IFRS 9. Now, the request sets out two potential views. Under the first view, the insurer considers that the premiums receivable from the intermediary are future cash flows within the boundary of an insurance contract, and so the premiums receivable would be accounted for under IFRS 17. Under the second view, because the payment by the policyholder discharges this obligation under the insurance contract, the insurer considers the right to receive premiums from the policyholder to be settled by the right to receive premiums from the intermediary. The insurer therefore determines that the premiums receivable from the intermediary are not future cash flows within the boundary of an insurance contract, but instead a separate financial asset within the scope of IFRS 9.
And where did the committee land on this fact pattern?
Well, actually, the committee concluded that because IFRS 17 is silent on when future cash flows within the boundary of an insurance contract are removed from the measurement of a group of insurance contracts, that an insurer could account for premiums receivable from an intermediary applying either IFRS 17 or IFRS 9. So that means that both of these views could be acceptable.
Thanks, Carsten. And one of the documents I'll link in the talking points that will accompany this podcast is the PwC IFRS 17 in transition, which summarizes the issue a little bit further for those that are interested. And that one is subject to a tentative agenda decision, so that will have a 60-day comment letter period. Is that correct, Carsten?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. Perfect, thank you. So in addition to the new submissions then, the committee were also provided with a potential annual improvement to obtain preliminary views. Now we've seen this done previously as well, and I think it's actually a very helpful tool to use in terms of, you know, running that past the committee as a first response. There were two topics of discussion, but perhaps we focus on the one that relates to a previous IFRIC submission, which was on the accounting for lease payments forgiven, and a question of IFRS 9 versus IFRS 16. The agenda decision suggested that the lessee accounting be considered for annual improvement, and this paper actually looks to address that further. So Carsten, can you summarise what the staff's proposal was?
Sure. So that's another one actually on the interaction of two standards, on the scoping of two standards, IFRS 9 and IFRS 16. So this, as you said, this goes back to a previous IFRIC submission, which asked about the accounting for rent concessions by both the lessee and the lessor. So consider a situation where a lessor agrees with the lessee that certain lease payments will be forgiven. Those lease payments may either be certain past or future lease payments for, say, particular months, or it may also be a proportion of past or future lease payments, so a part of those lease payments. Now, for the lessor, the issue was addressed by the IFRIC in an agenda decision that was finalized last year. I think it was published in October. However, for the lessee, the analysis discussed by the committee last year indicated that there might be more than one way to read the current requirements in IFRS standards. And so in order to reduce diversity in this area, the committee recommended that the ISB considers undertaking narrow scope standard setting, potentially as an annual improvement, to address the accounting by the lessee for rent concessions. So for the lessee, on a high level, the issue is whether lease payments that are forgiven by the lessor should be accounted for as an extinguishment applying IFRS 9 or as a lease modification applying IFRS 16. So when accounted for as a lease modification applying IFRS 16, there would generally be an adjustment to the lease liability and a corresponding adjustment to the right of use asset. On the other hand, when accounted for as an extinguishment or partial extinguishment applying IFRS 9, there would generally be a corresponding immediate P&L effect. However, there are a number of areas that are not entirely clear in the standards in that regard. First of all, it seems there currently is a lack of clarity in determining when a rent concession would be a lease modification and thus be accounted for under IFRS 16, and when it would be an extinguishment or partial extinguishment and thus be accounted for under IFRS 9. And even when it's accounted for under IFRS 9, some consider it not entirely clear whether the corresponding adjustment would be recognized immediately in profit or loss. So the staff now came back with proposals on a potential annual improvement intended to provide more clarity on the accounting for rent concessions for lessees. More specifically, the staff drafted an annual improvement that would essentially propose that the ISB would do two things. First, amend the definition of a lease modification in IFRS 16, and second, amend the scope paragraph in IFRS 9 that says that lease liabilities are subject to the derecognition requirements in IFRS 9. The latter would involve addressing, you know, adding a cross-reference in that scope paragraph to paragraph 333 of IFRS 9, in order to clarify that the difference between the carrying amount of a lease liability that has been extinguished and the related consideration paid, which is typically nil for rent concessions, would be recognized in profit or loss.
And what were the committee's views on this topic?
Well, I think it's fair to say that, you know, almost all committee members were not supportive of the staff's proposals around amending the definition of a lease modification. Many committee members felt that the proposals would not necessarily provide more clarity around when a rent concession would be in the scope of IFRS 16 and when it would be in the scope of IFRS 9. There was more support to potentially add that cross-reference to the scoping paragraph in IFRS 9 to clarify that any difference would be recognized in profit or loss for those rent concessions that are accounted for under IFRS 9. However, overall, most committee members were not supportive to go ahead with an annual improvement in the way that it has been proposed by the staff, mainly due to concerns that even with those amendments, it would still be unclear for some rent concessions whether they would be in the scope of IFRS 16 or in the scope of IFRS 9. Also, many committee members felt that the amendments as proposed by the staff would likely go beyond an annual improvement. And so if the board intends to do something about this issue, it should be dealt with either as part of the IFRS 16 PIR, so the post-implementation review, or as a separate standard setting project rather than as an annual improvement.
Thanks, Carsten. And I think that's always a concern, isn't it, with the potential annual improvement is possible wider implications. So I think that's a really helpful summary. So thanks for providing that. If we move on to the final item that was on the agenda, this was a paper that was discussing possible changes to the impairment test of cash generating units containing goodwill. Can you provide a summary of the discussions at the IFRIC with respect to this business combinations project, Carsten?
Sure. So that's quite an extensive topic, and I'm conscious that we are running out of time. So I'll just focus on informing our listeners on a high level about, you know, the topics that were brought to the committee for input. Now, for background, as many of you will be aware, the board currently has an active project on business combinations on their agenda, focusing on disclosures, goodwill, and impairment. Now, in the post-implementation review of IFRS 3, feedback from stakeholders indicated that impairment losses are sometimes recognized too late, and that the impairment test of cash-generating units, or CGUs, containing goodwill is, you know, complex, time-consuming, and also requires significant judgment. Now, on this background, committee members were asked to provide input on that project, focusing on possible changes to the impairment test of cash-generating units containing goodwill. More specifically, committee members were asked to provide input on a number of suggested changes to the impairment test of CGUs containing goodwill, including suggestions aiming to reduce management over-optimism, suggestions to reduce shielding, and suggestions that could reduce costs and complexity of the impairment test. So the aim was essentially, you know, to leverage the practical experience of the committee and ask the committee for recommendations on those areas. So the board will now consider this feedback from committee members, along with feedback from other stakeholders, when discussing possible changes to the requirements for the impairment test in IS 36.
Thanks, Carsten. So more to see on that when the project is being discussed at the board meetings, I guess. Perfect. So I think that brings us towards the end of our podcast. I'd like to thank you for joining me again today, Carsten. We look forward to seeing how all the issues that we've discussed develop going forward. And I really appreciate you joining us, providing us an overview of the March meeting.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of our March IFRIC update. Thank you to all our listeners. I hope you found it useful. And until next time, happy accounting.
The preceding programme was brought to you by PricewaterhouseCoopers LLP. This content is for general information purposes and is not a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.